Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome back to the Dan Wotton Interview, the podcast that brings the biggest names in showbiz direct into your headphones. This week, I welcome an absolute singing legend and pop icon. She is the longest serving member and the founding member, I should say, of the iconic Motown band, The Supremes. Their smash hits, including Baby Love and Stop in the Name of Love, inspired the musical Dreamgirls, which of course won 2 Oscars. And now, speaking of Oscars, the Motown story featuring Mary Wilson is about to be made into a major documentary film. So we'll be talking about that. But look, while her career has been stellar, it is fair to say Mary Wilson has endured heartbreak and the darker side of fame. Yes, Mary Wilson lost her teenage son in a tragic car accident. She was the driver of that vehicle, and then faced endless comparisons to her Supremes co-star Diana Ross, who she feuded with for years. But she rose up and she's come back bigger, better and stronger at a spectacular 75 years old to talk about the history of Motown, all of the racism the group had to face at the time, and what the royal family and the Beatles were really like in the 60s. I'm delighted to have Mary Wilson here today. Of course, if you do enjoy this interview, there's so many more where they came from. You won't believe the names actually we've had on the podcast this year. Madonna, Sheryl Crow, Dolly Parton, so many legends. If you subscribe to the podcast now, you get it absolutely free as soon as it becomes available. And you can listen to all of those interviews as well in the back catalogue. They are all there and I really, really do recommend it. At the end of the podcast, I'll have all of your feedback about my recent interview with Keane. It was a very emotional one. But right now, let's go up close and in depth. This is the irreplaceable Mary Wilson of The Supremes. Mary, welcome to London. Welcome to the podcast. It is so great to have you here.
You know what? I'm thrilled to be here in London. It's one of my favorite places, you know this.
Well, I know, because I was really struck by a line in your book, Supreme Glamour, which is this beautiful coffee table
yes.
book, which has just been released. It's got great outfits, but where you also tell the entire story of the Supremes. And I love this line where you talk about visiting London in the mid-60s, and you say it was like a second home. And you say the difference was, as you arrived in London, not as black women, but as stars.
Yes.
And it was a moment for you, wasn't it?
Well, you know, because we started singing, we being the Supremes, first the Primettes, we started singing in 1959. Mm. So when we came to London, it was 1964. All of those years prior to that, we were not stars at all. Mm. And also, we were black women women, first of all, were not as prominent as they are today. And also black women were not prominent at all, because black people still weren't even citizens.
Well, I know. And that's what's so hard for me to get my head around. Here you have the Supremes, the number one girl band in America, appearing constantly on the Ed Sullivan Show, number one after number one. But at the same time, America is in the middle of the civil rights movement. And in some places where you toured, I believe
there was still a degree of segregation.
Well, earlier on, yes, of course. I mean, as I said, the Civil Rights Bill was not passed until, what, 64, 65. The point being is that in America, black people still, even today, we're talking with the political whatever's going on, and people saying, well, you're racist. So you see, it still exists, but the laws have changed. Back then, the law was, if you're black, you can't vote, you can't do this, you can't do anything. So when we became famous in 1964 and a half, 65, that changed the whole atmosphere of America, because prior to that, we were not glamorous. You didn't think of a black person as being, you wouldn't even let a black person into your neighborhood. We still lived in segregated neighborhoods in 1964.
Well, absolutely. It was living history. And Whoopi Goldberg, who has written the foreword for this book, is one of the major African-American celebrities, the other being Oprah, who has said that without the Supremes, they don't believe they would have had the confidence to do what they ended up doing.
Well, what both Whoopi and Oprah were saying is pretty much what most black women would say, even us, even our parents would say, because we were not known to be, black people just weren't accepted. we were just black people. And that, you know, we said, if you're white, you're right. If you're black, you get back. You know, that kind of thing. That's just the way it was then. Thank God now the laws have changed, but some of the attitudes have not.
No,
that's what people are experiencing now.
But I mean, it did make your success even more extraordinary, didn't it? Because as you say, not only were you black, you were women. And we were seeing these sexy, empowered women on TV.
And guess what? We were not the only ones. You were seeing three at the same time.
Yeah.
Wearing the same dress.
Yeah.
Now, prior to that, you had, especially here in France, you had Miss Josephine Baker. So there were black women who had achieved what we had achieved, Lena Horne, all that. But still, they were black women. And many times, say, a person like Lena Horne, Miss Lena Horne, could not stay in the same place as where she performed, even though she was a star. Then in the 1964, of course, in America, we had the British invasion come through. And then we had the Supremes, Motown, come through. So then the borders were opening up. So attitudes were changing. And we happened to have been there just when the attitudes had changed. And television was another thing that gave this more of an awareness of other people. Now, you know, it's all about, well, let's make sure we have diversity, you know, which means let's let the other people in there. Back then, adversity was not something that they were not welcoming black people to do whatever. Somehow or another, the music and all these things helped us to break through in the 60s, and that changed everything.
And you called yourselves the Blaps.
I called us. It Blaps because it's Black American Princesses. That's what I called us.
And that actually
you
meant something.
You did read my book, didn't you,
honey?
Oh,
it's an amazing book. It's an amazing book. No, I was gripped to every word, Mary.
You.
It really is a fascinating book because you achieved so much at a time when really every single odd was stacked against you guys becoming successful. And in fact, in those early days, you weren't. You know, it took a long time. And another thing you used to call the Supremes in the early days.
No hit Supremes. You see, I'm happy that you're saying all this because I didn't know when we were writing, my writer, Mark Beagle, and I, when we were writing this, I had to try to change it around somewhat because I had already written the biography of the Supremes. So a lot of this was there, but I had to sort of write it now, this time with a different purpose in mind, so people could really be clear on what we were doing. This is a history lesson, actually.
It is.
But it's different from my first one in that I really had to put a lot of things in there. And the things that I put in there, you've brought up. So I'm saying that it has worked because I've said a lot of things before in the first books. But this time I tried to do it a different way.
Well, yeah, and also I guess it's three decades on from when you first released the autobiography. And I guess as a result, the Supremes' place in cultural history has now been firmly established because maybe at the time it was too fresh. You'd only split up a decade earlier.
And also I think sometimes there's a time, a certain time for certain things to happen, enough time has passed. So people are really interested in the history. Like we were talking about the documentary of Motown. There was a time when it was still going on, as you said. It wasn't as important. I think now that time has passed, people are saying, yeah, you know, that. All that to happen then, that was pretty fantastic.
Shuffle, delete, repeat.
Your three options are Baby Love from 1964, of course, from the album Where Did Out Love Go? Reach number one here in the UK, of course. From 1966, this is your second choice, You Can't Hurry Love. The album was the first all-female group to reach number one on the US album chart. And then from number 68, I love this one, I'm Gonna Make You Love Me.
I'm gonna shower.
From the album, Diana Ross and the Supremes joined the Temptations. It reached number three in the UK charts.
So what am I supposed to do?
So you have to choose out of them which one you want to repeat, so listen to again right now, which you want to put on shuffle, which means you'll
I'm
come back
make
to
you
it
love
later.
Me.
That's going to be your repeat?
Yeah.
Okay. Which would you delete then out of Baby Love or You Can't Hurry Love?
Neither one. But anyway, if I have to.
But you have to.
But I have to.
You have to.
Okay. Why do I delete it?
Because it's the game.
And it's the game. Okay. I just want to know why so then I can make okay. Let's delete Baby Love.
In this documentary, we should mention it, actually. It's coming to screens in the UK
September
over the next few
30th,
weeks.
September 30th,
yeah, and it's
I've
called
heard.
Hitsville. And it is the official story of Motown. You've got Smokey Robinson. You've got Berry Gordy, the man himself. You are there representing the story of the Supremes. And there's this talk about how Motown really, really was a production line of pop stars. It was truly the first time that had been done. But it wasn't always easy, was it, to be a young star? Because, of course, you, Diana Ross and Florence, you know, you were school kids, teenagers, when you first got together.
Yeah. We were young teenagers, actually. It was in 1959 when we first started singing.
And after a few years, Motown say, okay, we're going to put you on this production line.
No, that's not true.
So what happened?
I'm not going to tell you. No, I'm just going to go. I gotcha. No. No.
Because didn't they say to begin with, you're too young. Go back to school.
I know. He's got to make up for it. No, I'm only kidding you. But really, we actually made them take us. And I always say that because it's like, well, Motown went out and found all these stars. And so my thing is letting people know that when we first auditioned, I'm sure Mr. Gordy liked us a lot. But we were four young girls. I mean, we weren't even 16 yet because we didn't sign the contract until we were 16. So we must have been every bit of 15 years old. And I'm sure as a young company coming up and seeing these little teenage girls come into your company and want to sign, and you're looking at three, and we got all these, you know, these males around. He's like, I don't want to be responsible for those girls. So I'm sure Mr. Gordy probably said, you know what, come back and see us after you graduate from high school. That was his way of, you know, just. But we didn't realize that. We thought he was like saying we weren't good. And we don't want you, you know. We're like, what is it? I remember walking out the door and Florence said, he can't be that great if he doesn't know how good we are. We're only 15 years old. But what happened was, the reason why I say I have to let everyone know that we made them take us, that when we went away, we recorded some music at some recording studio, Lupine Records, it was called. And we recorded with Wilson Pickett and the Falcons, a lot of people like that doing backup. And we said, you know what? We really want to be at Motown. And so we went back to Motown, and every day we'd sit outside the building and just wait there. And Mary Wells come in, we'd say, hey, Mary, yes, Mary, hi! You know, and so the Mary was like, oh, there, oh! You know, and pretty soon one of the producers came on and said, wherever our background singers or our hand clappers, whatever. And we said, we'll do it. That's how we got in the door. So now we're in the door, doing just backup, some for Marvin Gaye. I think we did a couple for Mary Wells. Not any hits or whatever. And pretty soon, Mr. Gordy said, you know, you girls are serious. Okay, I think I'll sign you. And that's how we got in. So that's why I said we actually made him like us. Yeah.
We hustled, honey.
We were only 15 years old. We didn't sign the contract until we became 16.
Yeah.
So, you know, we definitely did, as three little girls knew what we wanted. Not that we wanted to be stars or make records. We were singing.
But by the time you had that massive first number one single, you were down to three. And it had been a tough road to begin with, hadn't it? Because you had released single after single after single.
And that's when we were the no-hit Supremes.
Well, yeah. And maybe now, you see, Mary, what I'm thinking is a record company would have axed you by that point. But Barry Gordy, it's like he believed, for some reason, he knew the Supremes were going to be massive. He just needed to find you that hit.
You're right. You're right on that. I think what Mr. Gordy saw in us was something that was very special, because we really were good. If you think about it, four young girls, and we made our way into the studio, into his whatever, and they could see that we were really serious and good at what we were doing, and so they went along with that. And as you said, had we been with another record company, they may have said, hey, look, we can't keep spending money on you guys, go and find somebody else. But he didn't. He really saw what we had, and I'm forever grateful that, he did.
Through the mirror of my mind, time after time, I see reflections of you and me. Reflections of the way life used to be. Reflections of the love you took from me. Oh, I'm all alone now. No love to shield me. Trapped in a world that I
But my goodness, Mary, it was a roller coaster ride in so many ways. And I have to cover some of those big moments which you talk about, honestly, in the book. So obviously, to begin with, your school friends, you start equally, Diana, Flo, and you.
And Betty.
Yes,
and
who then, ended up leaving.
And then she was replaced by Barbara, who ended up leaving. Yeah. And then we said, you know what?
It works.
We might as well stay as a trio. We can't get another. So that, yes.
But to begin with, it was just the Supremes. And then Diana Ross ends up in some type of relationship with Barry Gordy. And he decides, no, I want her out front. And I want to rename the band
they weren't
Diana
dating,
Ross
they
and
weren't,
the Supremes.
They weren't dating at that time.
That came out later.
Yes, I know. He chose Diane because she had the pop sound that he liked.
Yeah.
And Florence had a more R&B kind of gospel-y, like Etta James or Aretha voice. And my voice has always been just kind of like a nice ballad. And so he liked Diane's voice for the music. And that's how he chose her.
How difficult was it for you as a band?
At that point, are you kidding? We loved it because you know why? Then we were in. I mean, he liked one of us, for the thing. And so we were happy that he chose one of us, I say we, Florence and I, had he chose any one of us, we would have been happy. We were just happy he chose us. Never, ever talked about that being a problem. That became a problem much later.
And I guess it was working because you had it number one after number one.
We were happy. I think when it became not a problem, but something that you start thinking about, because we were still young and happy to be there. But after a while, if you have a talent, you want to use it. So sometimes if a song would come that, you felt it was a ballad and I wanted to sing that, when he was like, oh, I didn't get that. Then slowly those kind of things, those moments starts happening. But it wasn't something that all of a sudden started, happening and then whatever. And then we started talking about it. People tend to think that, but that's not true.
Although Barry does admit in the documentary that his relationship with Diana was difficult, it was tumultuous, and he considered walking away from the band.
You know, the thing about it is he felt that way probably with Marvin Gaye, wanted to do ballads, if it wasn't his way, he was not. So that's not a big problem. It was something that was there. Yes, I'm not disagreeing with that. But it wasn't something where he was going to stop. Because we were still having hit records. As long as we had hit records, trust me, he wasn't going to let us go. But their relationship did become something else. And I often don't talk about that because, you know, it's a personal relationship. But it really did have a lot to do with the direction of the group, I'll say. And I'm sure in his mind, it most certainly did. So, you know, like I say, sometimes in life, things like that happen, and you've got to know how to roll with the punches in order to still get what you want. So that's what I did.
And you are living the dream. There's some great moments I want to talk about. I mean, there's this moment when you're in the UK and you meet the Beatles for the first time. And of course, you were the biggest girl group in the world.
Yeah.
The Beatles were the biggest boy group in the world. Everyone was expecting this electric chemistry.
Yeah.
But you say at the first meeting, it just wasn't there.
We met them at the Warwick Hotel. That was in New York. And the first meeting was here in London. And that one was sort of just fly by night because I think, what was the name of that club? Mary Bell's? No, what was one of the clubs?
Oh, Annabelle's.
Annabelle's or something like that. Yeah. And so that was, it was a brief meeting and it was like, you know, it was like, But when we really didn't make it was at the Warwick. And that was
because they were smoking.
They
wheat.
Were. I didn't say that.
It's your it show. Smelled of
it's
wheat.
Your is your show. You can say what you want to say. In fact, George Harrison and I became friends years later, and we talked about that meeting. And so he said, "Well, yeah." He says, "You know, we thought you girls were going to come in there and be like, you know, who was the guy? Bob Dylan, and the Ronettes, and all these people." And so they were like really hip people. We were kind of square girls. And it seemed like maybe they had been smoking. I don't know who was, but we just weren't used to it. And so we were ready to go. And George said, "Yeah, we were ready for you girls to go too, because you were killing our groove."
And then you also have this incredible meeting with many members of the royal family. So you meet the Queen Mother. There's that iconic picture of you guys there, and you now call it the Queen Mother dress.
Yes.
But Mary, someone wasn't quite as polite. Certain Princess Margaret annoyed you just a little bit.
What wig you wearing, darling? My worst English accent. Is that
no, it's good. It's good.
And she said it so loudly. You know, we had just done the performance at the Royal Albert Hall, right? And so, you know, we were just happy to have been there. And it was the Queen Mother was there. I think Prince Charles was there. Princess Anne, Princess Margaret. So we were in the receiving line, and everyone's coming through there, and you know we're being as cute and polite as we could be, and when Princess Margaret came, she stopped in front of me. I don't know why she stopped in front of me and said, "Ooh, Mary, is that a wig you're wearing?" So it wasn't so much that it was like when your parents, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. That was because everyone knew we wore the long lashes, the wigs, the hair pieces big, you know, the eyelashes. We did, you know, we went over the top. We were kind of like, more is better, right? So I felt so embarrassed because I didn't think royalty people acted the same way my neighbors did. I mean, she reminded me of somebody who lived in the projects, right? I hate to say this. You probably will hate me, all the English people, for saying that. But anyway, it was a little embarrassing. And had she just whispered and said, "Excuse me, Mary, is that a hairpiece you wear?"
But you think she wanted to humiliate
you? No, I didn't think she wanted. I think that's the way she was.
Yeah.
She and I became very, we became great friends. I did a lot of her charity shows that she had here. I was always there. We became very friendly. But it was just that first meeting. It was like she acted like she knew me for ages, and something you would say at a backyard party, not at the, you know, role. So I was very taken aback by it. But I got over it, I think. Ooh, is that a wig you're wearing?
Well, you clearly got over it if you ended up good friends.
We did. We ended up with best friends. Yes, we did.
And likewise with George Harrison, too. And at around that same time, speaking of living history, a little bit later, of course, you learned of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And you were actually one of the celebrities at his funeral.
Yes.
Had you met him? Because obviously he did have an association with Motown in a way, didn't he? He loved Berry Gordy and what he was doing.
Well, you know, first of all, it was what they both were doing. There were a lot of Afro-American who were accomplishing great things at that time. And Berry Gordy and Martin Luther King did develop a wonderful relationship. In fact, Motown recorded one of Mr. King's speeches. Mm. So, you know, they had a relationship. And a lot of times Mr. King would come on the road Or maybe we would be in some city and he would be at the same time. So he and Mr. Gordy would get together. We never had long talks with him ourselves because we were females and they were talking about, you know, the civil rights and all those kind of things. And so we always saw him and he was always very polite, loved the music and all those kind of things. So when he passed, when he was assassinated, let's say, we were working at the Copacabana. And so when this happened, we were asked to come over to Johnny Carson's show to sing on the show because of that. And so we did go and on television and we sang somewhere.
There's a place for us. Somewhere a place for us. Peace and quiet and all.
And so what happened was it was a tribute for that. And in the middle of it, and I bring this up because in the middle of the song, Diane made a speech where they had changed the monologue, so that it would really have a lot to say about the loss of Mr. King.
And then you're alongside all of these greats at his funeral.
Mm-hmm. Every great star, Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, Lena Horne, everyone was there. Because we all have been in the fight, you know, in the civil rights movement, as individual artists, doing certain things. So it was only fitting that we all would be there for that. And we were like right down front. It was, it was a monumental moment of loss.
And it's so easy to see why he was so supportive of Motown, because it was artists like you that made the change to ordinary white Americans.
And see, we all were in the fight in our own way.
Of course.
As I said, we would all run into each other. I remember Lena Horne doing a speech with, I can't remember where it was, but she was speaking about some of the hardships and things. So we all were involved in this civil rights. So that's why we rallied around Mr. King, because he was the one who really was like the head, you know what I mean? He spoke what we all wanted to achieve.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And of course, it wasn't that long after that tragedy struck the Supremes as well. Mm-hmm. Florence, who had obviously had difficult times and ended up leaving the group. And I mean, she'd had very difficult teenage years. Mm-hmm. She'd been sexually assaulted and, you know, a tough life. She died. What impact was that on you, given how close you were and what you'd shared together?
Well, you know, the three of us were totally girlfriends, you know, childhood friends, girlfriends, in terms of the relationships between the three of us. It was about the singing. It was about growing up together, and all that. The closeness was something that you never overcome that. I mean, even now, I still feel like they're as close to me as my sister. Mm-hmm. You know, that close. We share it so much. Florence had a childhood of just not a something. You know what let me say this. You know, now every woman or child who has been abused is able to say it out loud. Back then when that happened, Florence was never ever able to say anything. So people didn't know what had happened to her except Diane and I. And when she told us about it, and I wrote about this in the book, and I told exactly what Florence said to us. And we were only, 14 years old, all virgins. And so this kind of, when we finally saw her and she told us what had happened to her, I could see not only the pain in her, but I could see that her soul had just been totally destroyed at that moment. When she, you know, if you see someone happy 1 minute, then they tell you what happened. And this was like a real moment, talking about reality. It was like, whoa, I couldn't even imagine what she was talking about, you know, being a virgin and all this stuff, and then having someone you don't even know. So now people are able to come forward and say, this happened to me and that person did it. There's such a release in saying that. But Florence never had that opportunity. So therefore, you know, when we became famous, years later, I thought that, you know, she probably was over because now we're rich and we're famous and all this stuff. But hey, you know, we're on top of the world. We're the famous group in the world. And Florence was not able to enjoy that moment because everything took her right back to, for some reason, back to that. And so that's the reason why I wrote about it, because I hate when people say, oh, yeah, one of the girls was a drug addict. No, not drug addict. I said one of the girls was an alcoholic. Yeah, well, no, she was just hiding her pain and nobody listened, you know, to her. I didn't know how to help her. You know, I tried to talk and be her best friend, but that was not what she needed. She needed, you know, therapy and help.
Play a sad song for a girl with a broken heart.
And that's why I guess it's so important now with the Me Too movement and how much people have spoken about things like that. Because, I mean, did you struggle at all? Were there ever any moments when you were a young woman and people in the industry tried to take advantage of you at that time?
I was never into anything like that at all. Nothing like that ever happened to me. I do know, I can tell you this, though. I can tell you that probably every woman my age have... If it hasn't happened to them, they know about it. Because I hate to say this, men, I'm not talking about you. I love men, but men do take advantage when they can. And if you don't have anyone to protect you or to talk about it, you know, stop them yourself, men will do that. It happens. I mean, women will too sometimes, but I mean, it's not as rampant.
No.
Because we grew up at a time, I don't know here, but in America, where men... What does it say? It's a man's world, you know, and women are subservient. So that was that during that time, you know, when that still was a belief.
Yeah, well, of course. And you write about in the fact in the book that when it came to finances, it was the same thing for every million records you sold. And I know it was a lot of money back then, but still, given you were selling a million records, you would only make $5,000.
I don't know what the amount was, because if I wrote about it, and I wrote about it because the percentages were definitely kind of what you're talking about in terms of us making the money, but we did not. That's how the contracts were back then. And if you go even further than that, some of the doo-wop groups, you know, who didn't get any percentages, you know. So we would have been happy. I would have given my grandchildren away.
Yeah.
Okay, had I thought I was going to have some, but I was too young. I never thought I was going to have any grandchildren. Who thought about being old? Now I would not do that. But I would have signed if they had not given me, you know, anything. I would have signed. But now you look back and you see, oh, wow, we really should have, you know, someone should have taken care that we got a little bit more. But you learn that if that happens, people do take advantage. And I tell everyone, make sure you get a lawyer and make sure you have he or she explain to you every little thing. So, and I want this very clear because it's very true. I don't take back anything I said about the financial situation, but I do say that had we been able to have a lawyer, we could have fared better later on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also, I'm sorry, and to read the small print. That's what I was trying to say.
Yes.
We didn't read the small print.
The Five.
Each week, I ask my guests about five songs that mean a lot to them.
Okay.
And of course, because your book is Supreme Glamour, I wanted you to choose today the five Supreme songs that, looking back all of this time later, mean the most to you.
Five.
Yeah.
Ooh,
so
wow.
What is your first Supreme song choice?
First one would be Reflections. Yeah, that would be number one. The next one would be Come See About Me. Next one would be Stone Love. Next one would be Up the Ladder to the Roof. Each of them have a special meaning, a different meaning. I Hear a Symphony was the first song record that we had that was more mature. And we were young teenage girls, so we wanted to be more mature. And so when that record was, I felt very elegant and mature. So it was the first one that I really had that feeling of, you know, we're growing up, we're elegant. Whenever you're near,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The other big storyline, of course, at the end of that incredible decade of the 60s was the departure of Diana Ross from the Supremes.
Yes.
You obviously became the front woman of the group. It was actually great for you personally. You had more hits with a new lineup. But it's fair to say that for the next 10 years, your relationship with Diana became very strained. How difficult was it? Talk to me about that relationship with Diana. As you say, you view her like a sister, but you went through tough times, didn't
well,
you?
Well, I mean, the thing that people need to understand is that for a group to have, you know, be so close and then one person leaves, you know, there's going to be a little friction there, and it depends on how much love you have in it. If you're a family group like the Jacksons, well, obviously they, you know, Michael left, but they still had that love because of the family thing. If you're not family, it could be a little, it could be more difficult. Let's put, I don't know if more difficult is the way you grammatically say, but it's true. And so with us, because of the love, there was no hatred, but yet and still, you know, what saved me was the fact that we got another singer in there to replace Florence. Let's go back there, which was Cindy Birdsong, who is one of the most beautiful human beings in the world. So I was able to carry on with Florence singing, with Cindy Birdsong singing in the background with me. However, my heart was still aching for Florence Ballard. But because Cindy was such a groovy person, you know, it was easier, but the pain was still there, the loss. I mean, it was like we were not the same group. Then when Diane left the group, it was devastating, but we had Jean Jarrell who came in, who had a great voice, a great whatever, and she brought a whole new persona to the group. So that kind of saved me, you know, but still, I totally missed Florence and Diane, period. And it was not easy. So for me, it was a whole new group. But I had to take over the management and everything. So I was so consumed with making the group work that I didn't have a chance to really mourn a lot. But yet still, the hurt was still there. I mean, even now, I miss both Florence and Diane deeply. But it wasn't easy to move on because I knew I enjoyed performing. I enjoyed being on that stage. And anything I could do to keep the Supremes great was what I wanted to do.
What about now, Mary? Because, of course, Diana did reform the Supremes about nearly two decades ago now.
No, she did not reform the Supremes.
Or there was a reunion.
No, it wasn't a reunion. Who was she reunion with?
Well, she had two former
members
of the Supremes.
But that wasn't a reunion would be me or Florence.
Yeah.
The thing is, there was supposed to be a reunion.
Yeah,
which would have been Florence or Cindy Birdsong and myself. That would have been a reunion.
With Diana Ross.
With Diana, of course. So when you have a group and they break up and you have a reunion, you come back with the members, right? Now, if you're going to get two other people who were not in your group, that's not a reunion. So what happened was I did not choose not to be there when they were negotiating with me. They said this is what we're giving, and that's it. And I'm like, well, hold on just a minute. You know what I mean? I'm one of the founding members. You know, so I don't want to get the same as Diane. I understand that Diane gets this, and I should be next, and then Cindy, whatever. And they were going to give me the same as Cindy was getting. I'm like, Cindy is a replacement. Mm. She didn't make those records. I mean, this has nothing to do against her. I love her because she saved the group by coming in, because people didn't even know that she was in, but they still thought it was Florence. They looked so much alike. Mm. And she was a sweetheart, too. But, so they would not negotiate with me. They said, no, you take this and that's it. And I said, well, you know, I write books. I had already had a bestseller. I'd like to write a book about it. You know, just certain things I wanted to negotiate on. They said, no, this is it. I couldn't choose what gown.
But it didn't work without you, maybe.
Well, so I, you know, and we always, the choreography. I mean, I did the choreography, right? So, I mean, if they weren't even going to have me as a consult on any of the, I mean, things that I was involved in, I'm like, so I said, listen, this is what I want. And they said, no, you take what we give and that's it. And so I didn't, I just, you know, couldn't go. That's what happened.
And so what about now? Because... Mm-hmm. People still hope it
could happen. I know. Everyone wants us to get to... But the fans would love it if we got back together.
And you could, because you've still got Cindy.
No, but Diane will have to want to do it.
Has there been any talk?
What do you mean?
Between you guys.
Everyone's talking. Not us, but everyone's talking about it. Yeah. People would love it. But Diane's got to want to do it.
Would you want to do it?
It doesn't matter. If she wants to do it, I'm there. I wanted to do it before. She has got to want... to do it.
But you saw her earlier this year, didn't you, at Elton John's party. How was that?
Oh, great.
So your relationship is okay?
We always get along. See, the people don't realize it's not about she and I not liking each other. We love each other. But the business is whatever. So she's got to understand, she's got to want to do this. I already want to do it, but I can't do it without her, and I would not do it. How could I do it without her?
Yeah.
I've been asked even to have a reunion with the 70 Supremes, but why should I do that and not do one with Diane? So it's really up to Diane. That's why I say she's got to want to do
it. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Mm-hmm.
Everyone's keeping their fingers crossed. They are. I'm serious.
No, absolutely.
And so, I'm not going to stop my life because it doesn't happen.
No. But you think it will?
No, I don't think it will. I don't think it will, because I don't think Diane needs to do it. She's got a need to do it in terms of her wants, you know, like to relive and do that for her, for the fans. You know what I mean? Need to, in that way, to do it. Those two ladies were great singers. I brought them into the group myself, Sherry Payne and Linda Lawrence. I mean, those are two ladies I picked to come into the Supremes, but they were not with Diane. They were with me. So that's not a reunion. And as I said, they're totally talented women, but it was not a reunion. That's why it didn't work, because it was not a reunion.
Absolutely. No, look, I've got to talk to you personally as well.
Thank you. At last. No, just kidding. I love talking about it, so don't worry.
But you've had tragedy in your life, Mary. Mm-hmm. People have so much respect for the fact that in the 80s you dealt with the worst thing that anyone can deal with, the death of your son. He was a teenager in a car crash. And I just wonder how you were able to come back in the way you were after that type of tragedy, which, let's be honest, floors so many people forever.
It does. I have a lot of girlfriends who have lost their child. And it was not something that I expected. It was so unexpected. It was a car accident, and I was driving it, driving the car. But, you know, he and I both had gotten a lot of sleep that night. I had not been drinking or anything like that. And it happened. It was really devastating. But I tell you what perhaps prepared me for that kind of a loss was when Florence died. She died in 1976, and that was the first time I had ever had that kind of death where it affected me. So someone I knew, my best friend, and so I was. That was devastating. I mean, I think that Florence's death was one of those things where I became an adult. You know, I was like, whoa, this is reality. This is real. And then when my son died, I kind of understood that realness that can happen. It's a scary thing. And I think the only thing that got me through was probably just being who I am. I mean, I am the kind of person that I'm very resilient. And just that my other son said to me, Mom, he says, you know, losing Ralphie was like having a hole in my heart. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. It's like a hole. But you still got your heart. You still have your heart. And I think that's what got me through, still having you know, that heart, and then knowing that life can be up and it can be down, and you got to learn how to roll with the punches, as they say. And sometimes you never get over that. I mean, I'm not over it. I'll never be over it. I'll see his picture. I have his picture all over my house, and sometimes I'll look at it and I'll just bust into tears, you know, and sometimes I'll just smile. And some, you know, you just got to, something in you, you've got to have that.
What an incredible woman. What an incredible life
you
have had. Mary Wilson, Supreme Glamour, is out now. Thank you so much for being
here
today.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
What a woman. Now, of course, if you want more A-list interviews like that, you just need to subscribe to the podcast, The Dan Wooten Interview. Lots of huge names have stepped in this year to talk about their careers, including Sheryl Crow, Celine Dion, Madonna, and Dolly Parton. But on a recent podcast, I had the comeback interview with the incredible band Keane. And wow, Tim Rice-Oxley and Tom Chaplin have been through a heck of a lot. And they opened up about it in really honest and emotional detail, especially given it involved alcoholism, drug addiction, and the breakdown of a marriage. So as you would imagine, there was huge reaction to that interview. Nikki Brown messaged me to say, love this band for a long time. This interview was exactly what I wanted to hear. Honest, relaxed, and genuinely excited about what's to come. Can't wait for the album. Gab Stepp, she messaged in to say, so refreshing to finally hear from Tim himself. I know it must be hard to speak about all of the issues and lows he's been going through, but I believe it will be even more liberating to tell the story himself, just as Tom did when The Wave was released. I couldn't agree more, actually. And Lizzie Ian, she wrote in to me to say, it's very brave of them to be so honest, and Dan really hit the right tone, a great skill to have. It makes us better to understand those very personal songs as well. That, together with their song choices, made for a really fascinating listen indeed. So if you want to hear that full interview with Keane, of course, their new album out very, very soon, just go back and you can check it out in the back catalogue. So if you subscribe to The Dan Wooten Interview, you will get the podcast the moment they become available. And I have some great ones actually over the next few weeks that I just know you won't want to miss. Thank you so much for listening today. I would love to know what you thought about this very special Supremes podcast. So all you need to do is find me on social media. You can look for Dan Wooten on Facebook, on Instagram, or on Twitter, and we'll have your best feedback on the next pod. But for now, thank you so much for being here. I'm Dan Wooten. Bye-bye.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.